As you're probably aware, the plays of William Shakespeare are held in great esteem, but that esteem does not stop people from thinking they can tweak the work of Shakespeare to make it just that much better. That feeling goes back nearly to Shakespeare's time itself. Camelot Theatre and Talent will host a lecture with readings this afternoon called Better Than Shakespeare, and it's Better Than Shakespeare with a question mark. Jeff Ridden is the developer of this project, and he'll be hosting it. That's 1 o'clock till 3 o'clock this afternoon at Camelot Theatre and Talent. As I like to think of you, the other Jeffrey R.
Thank you so much.
Because he's also a backup host at JPR. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be back. I'll be here tomorrow, too, but there you go, right?
That's right. Fun drive starts tomorrow. So tell us about yourself and your lifelong exposure and devotion to Shakespeare's work.
Okay. I've been working in the theater. I did my first show when I was three, so I've got 65 years behind me. I started, I know you worked that one out. I started studying Shakespeare at school, as we all did, and then I went on to do it at university, and I ended up teaching Shakespeare, but also continuing to act in Shakespeare's plays. So I've got a fair background there.
There's so much to learn just in Shakespeare's own work.
Right.
And his contemporaries' approaches to it. But at some point you remember, I'm sure, learning that other people had monkeyed with Shakespeare, which is what you're talking about today.
Quite. Oddly enough, Shakespeare himself monkeyed with Shakespeare because a play that was running at the festival this season, Richard II, was never performed, was only performed once in Shakespeare's day in the full version we now have. The scene in which Richard abdicates was cut because it was too politically controversial and was only staged in 1601 by the Earl of Essex the night before he wanted to stage a rebellion against the Queen. And it was closed down, not surprisingly. So people were monkeying with Shakespeare, even in Shakespeare's own day. Right.
But the theory you focus on here, is there one particular that you're looking at?
Sorry?
Is there one particular period of history that
yes,
you're
indeed.
On?
I'm looking particularly at the adaptations that were done immediately after the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, for about 100 years after that. So what happened is that the theatres were closed in 1642, when the Puritans took over during their reign, and then reopened in 1660 when the monarchy was restored under Charles II.
So think about it for a second. A generation of time in which people had no theater.
Right. And when the theater came back, it was a completely different animal. It was no longer the outdoor public stage. It was an indoor stage. And the audience was much more sophisticated, much more aristocratic.
No groundlings.
No groundlings. No fools, by and large. No writing for a specific company. And so playwrights started to think, well, first of all, we'll write our own plays, which they did, but then thinking, okay, if we're going to do Shakespeare, we're going to do Shakespeare as he would have written were he writing now. And one of the big differences was that there were women on the stage. So playwrights could now write for women, Shakespeare couldn't, and so they started intervening and extending the roles of women in Shakespeare's plays.
But Shakespeare wrote for women characters, I mean, how
sure,
different?
But they were played by boys, mm-hmm. right? And so what Shakespeare could do with those boys was limited to the talents of those particular boys, and they grew up, and their voices broke, and they grew beards, and so they had to be replaced. Whereas post-1660, you had first professional female actors.
Well, that's a whole class of people that pretty much had to be created out of whole cloth.
Absolutely, absolutely. And oddly enough, there was a strange overlap. There were just a few years when boy players were still on the stage playing women. And there was a famous young man called Edward Kynaston who worked in the early years of the 1660s and was regarded as the best woman on the stage. But gradually the women took him over and he lost his job. Yeah.
I mean, in a sense, are we lucky that Shakespeare's work itself survived, given this period that followed?
Fabulous question, because if we hadn't had these adaptations, we probably wouldn't have Shakespeare. People like David Garrick, the actor, was very interested in staging Shakespeare, but it was felt that many of Shakespeare's plays were unstageable. So he intervened because he wanted to act them, and he took The Winter's Tale, and he rewrote it. He just focused on the end in a version called Florizel and Perdita. And his version held the stage for about 150 years, until somebody said, well, let's go back and see what Shakespeare wrote. Without Garrick, there'd have been no Shakespeare continuity.
You have staged some of these as readings.
Indeed,
haven't you?
Yeah. We've been doing it for about a year now, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. And is the attraction to see where people have taken Shakespeare and taken a dog leg with it?
I think there are several attractions. One is the attraction to see, does this work on stage still? And the second is the sort of thrill that we are speaking words which probably nobody's heard for a couple of centuries. And often they do work. There are aspects to these adaptations, which in some respects can be superior to Shakespeare. You know, particularly the extra characters. We did a version of Timon by Thomas Shadwell. And Shadwell makes Timon, in a sense, more believable because he gives Timon a love interest. In fact, he gives him two. There are two competing mistresses. And Timon doesn't behave all that well to these women. And you start to feel, even in the first half of the play, I don't like this guy all that much. And it doesn't come as a shock, as it does with Shakespeare, when Timon has his downfall.
So I guess that answers the question about whether these were generally regarded as trash or whether they were improvements upon Shakespeare, and it sounds like you're saying some of them were.
They were, and they were good box office. I mean, the most notorious and one people may have heard of is an adaptation of King Lear by Nahum Tate, which gives King Lear a happy ending. Lear lives and Cordelia marries Edgar, and this is often derided by people, usually people who haven't seen it. But when you see it on stage, it makes a kind of sense, and that was the version of Lear that everybody saw. People read Shakespeare's version, but nobody performed it because it was too cruel. You couldn't see it on the stage. It was just too awful.
History seems to ebb and flow like that with theater, because as I was writing up questions for this segment, I was just thinking about you know, how drastic some of the rewrites were. If, for example, as Germany staged a Dollhouse by Ibsen the first time through, the ending was changed so that Nora stayed, which was kind of not the point.
Right. I mean, well, that is the wonderful thing, as you will know, about theatre, that no two performances are ever the same, and certainly no two productions are ever the same. And, you know, there are many people who I suppose you could say were purists, and they had this idea that they want the original Shakespeare. Well, you won't ever get it. Nobody does the full text, and there is no one text. Which text do you pick? And then which bits do you leave out? You know, there's always adaptation going on.
Jeff Ridden's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the founder of Classics Rereadings Company. He's a writer, teacher, actor, singer, and a lover of Shakespeare for many, many years. The company will be performing Better Than Shakespeare? At the end, which is about the rewrites of Shakespeare in the 17th and 18th centuries. Bits and pieces of several plays on stage at the Camelot Theater and Talent this afternoon, 1 to 3. You can join us on the Exchange now at 800-838-3760 to say if you think it is complete heresy or actually a pretty good idea to go rewrite Shakespeare. And you can also join us by email jx@jeffnet.org.
Can I just say there may be some tickets left for this afternoon's lecture? And if people are interested, they can contact the email olli@sou.edu.
olli@sou.edu. So this is part of the Osher Lifelong Learning
Institute. Indeed. They're sponsoring this event this afternoon,
Shakespeare and improvements. I mean, even if you love Shakespeare, there are people who will say, you know, that was Shakespeare's weakest play. I mean, such things are said.
Yeah, all the time. And in fact, I'll be talking a little bit about that this afternoon. And what tends to happen is that if somebody finds a play by Shakespeare they don't like, then there are two ways of explaining it away. One is saying, oh, well, it's early. You know, he hasn't really hit his stride yet. You're not looking at the right place. If it doesn't happen to be early, you say, ah, well, it's a collaboration. And all the best lines are by Shakespeare, and the bits you don't like are probably by Fletcher. So we get round it that way.
As these adaptations, particularly in the 17th and 18th centuries, were made, was it more generally addition or subtraction? I'm just wondering about whether their characters disappeared, plot lines disappeared, or whether more were added.
Right. I think there are three different ways of doing it. Dryden simply started with a blank sheet of paper and rewrote Antony and Cleopatra, and he called it All for Love, and it's a completely different play. Mm-hmm. Other people, particularly Tate, use lines by Shakespeare and then add their own. And that's difficult because the difference between the two can be startling. Yes, characters are added, particularly, as I was suggesting, women, and characters are subtracted, particularly low comedy. It was a taste issue. In the late 17th, early 18th century, people did not want Shakespeare to be rude. So they cut out the bawdy wherever they could, and any bawdy character would go.
As we got further into the Enlightenment and reason and science.
And we became more buttoned up. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
The idea of rewriting some of this work, and the lines themselves, you mentioned one of the playwrights who used the actual words of Shakespeare.
Right.
By now, 400 years plus after Shakespeare's death, I mean, some things are really rather locked in stone.
You know? Indeed.
There are more things in heaven and earth than I thought of in your dreamed of in your philosophy.
Right.
All the world's a stage, to be or not to be.
Yep.
In the 17th century, though, I can imagine that they hadn't built up the sort of locked-in-stone rep that they have now.
It's interesting to try and figure out and speculate what they were doing with that. That we're doing a play on Sunday. We're doing Tate's version of Richard II at the Mies Auditorium here on the SOU campus at 2 o'clock. And one of the startling things about that to me is that possibly the most famous speech in Richard II is John of Gaunt's Paean to England, this sceptred isle, this earth of majesty, etc.
This earth, this England.
Exactly. And Tate cuts it. I'm still trying to figure out why he does it. Does he cut it because it's so familiar? Or does he cut it as a joke? You know, you're expecting this. It's a bit like going, to be or not to be. Whatever. You know, I'm not going to give you the whole thing because you know it and you're going to join in. So to stop you mouthing the words as my actor says them, I'm not going to let him have it. I'm going to cut the speech, and that's what he does.
Have you listened to the productions of this before? I'm just curious to know if the audience goes, if when they hear things get...
I don't think this has been produced for a couple of hundred years, so certainly there are no recordings of it, no.
So through the process of producing Shakespeare over 400 years plus then, yep. I mean, have there been these sort of bursts of activity where, you know, there's a back-to-basics movement, let's use just Shakespeare, just his words as he wrote them in the original versions, let's use the later versions that Shakespeare did?
The back-to-basics thing is a fairly recent phenomenon. Even when people were going back to Shakespeare, they were doing the big theatrical stuff. In the 19th century, you wanted spectacle. Shakespeare didn't write battles, so we're going to do the battles anyway. And we're going to have dozens of actors on stage with swords, and we'll get horses on there. We'll make it a real spectacle, rather than concentrating on the words, which is what, you know, later productions have done. But I think when people want Shakespeare, they have this idea they want Shakespeare in traditional dress, and they don't know what that means. Actually, what it means is Shakespeare in the contemporary dress of his day. Shakespeare's actors did not, by and large, dress up in antique costumes. They wore the stuff they wore. My elder granddaughter has a wonderful line. She said to me a couple of years ago, "Grandpa, did you know that in the olden days, people didn't know it was the olden days? They thought it was now." And that's the kick.
She nailed it, though, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. She's very good, yes.
Wow, that's great. So given the rich history of bringing people on to work up Shakespeare in new ways, how did you manage to cram a couple of centuries of material into 2 hours this afternoon?
Right. Well, we're doing extracts. We're doing a series of extracts from plays we've done already, and we're doing a couple of trailers from Richard II, which we're doing on Sunday. So that's how the productions that we do are heavily cut. If we did the entire Tate version of Richard II, it would take about 4 hours. So my job is to adapt the adaptations and to cut them down to, we'll run for about an hour on Sunday, and we use the narrator a lot to fill in the gaps.
Are you generally bringing out for the Better Than Shakespeare compilation things that are regarded well, or are you putting some stinkers out there too, just to give some contrast?
You're right. We are doing both of those things. We're doing the Tate more or less in full this weekend on Sunday. After that, we're doing some extracts from versions of Hamlet in January and some extracts from versions of Romeo and Juliet in March. And the Romeo and Juliet one is called The Ending You Always Wanted. and it's people who leave them alive, which I think is, you know, something that we look forward to as an audience.
Are you doing this generally for Shakespeare lovers or casual theater goers?
I think, I mean, as your previous guest was saying, we've got a very sophisticated audience here in Ashland, and a lot of people come knowing a great deal about Shakespeare and a great deal about theatre, and I think are intrigued to hear what other writers did with him.
Given your knowledge of Shakespeare, are you pretty much familiar with everything extant that is connected to his work, or are there still some surprises that you can lay your hands
on? Oh, no, there are always surprises. What we've been trying to do is to complement the shows that are on at OSF. So last year we did a version of Pericles, a version of Antony and Cleopatra, a version of Winter's Tale, and a version of Timon. This year we're looking at Richard, and we're looking at Romeo and Juliet, because they're doing Shakespeare in Love. We're looking at Hamlet, and we'll look at Falstaff, Merrywives of Windsor. So that's the aim. Sometimes there aren't adaptations. There are no adaptations of Julius Caesar.
Really?
Clearly people thought that was either such a great play that they couldn't tinker with it, or that they didn't want to touch it.
Jeff Ridden, writer, teacher, actor, singer, founder of Classic Three Readings Company, doing Better Than Shakespeare this afternoon at 1 at the Camelot Theater in Talent. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And thank you for listening to the program. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Emily Curtin's our producer and controller and co-host. Take care and have a great day.